insistent horn behind her. It was a fancy car. Someone was signaling to her from the window. Lena! She looked closely. She recognized the wolfish face of Bruno Socavo, Nino's friend. What are you doing here? He asked.
I live here.
She said almost nothing about herself, since at that time such things were difficult to explain. She didn't mention Nino, nor did he. She asked instead if he had graduated. He said he had decided to stop studying.
Are you married?
Of course not.
Engaged?
One day, yes. The next, no.
What do you do?
Nothing. There are people who work for me. It occurred to her to ask him, almost as a joke,
would you give me a job?
You? What do you need a job for?
To work.
You want to make salami and mortadella?
Why not?
And your husband?
I don't have a husband anymore, but I have a son.
Bruno looked at her attentively to see if she was joking. He seemed confused, evasive. It's not a nice job, he said. Then he talked volubly about the problems of couples in general, about his mother, who was always fighting with his father, about a violent passion he himself had had recently for a married woman, but she had left him. Bruno was unusually talkative. He invited her to a cafe, continuing to tell her about himself. Finally, when Lila said she had to go, he asked, Did you really leave your husband? You really have a child?
Yes. He frowned,
wrote something on a napkin. Go to this man. You'll find him in the morning after 8, and show him this.
Lila smiled in embarrassment. The napkin?
Yes.
It's enough?
He nodded yes, suddenly made shy by her teasing tone. He murmured, That was a wonderful summer.
She said, For me too.
120. All this I found out later. I would have liked to use the address in San Giovanni that Ada had given me right away. But something crucial happened to me as well. One morning, I was lazily reading a long letter from Pietro, and at the end of the last page, I found a few lines in which he told me that he had had his mother read my text. That's what he called it. Adele had found it so good that she had typed it and had sent it to a publisher in Milan for whom she had done translations for years. They had liked it and wanted to publish it. It was a late autumn morning. I remember a gray light. I sat at the kitchen table, the same one on which my mother was ironing the clothes. The old iron slid over the material with energy. The wood vibrated under my elbows. I looked at those lines for a long time. I said softly, in Italian, only to convince myself that the thing was real. Mama, here, it says that they are going to publish a novel I wrote. My mother stopped. Lifted the iron off the material, set it down upright. You wrote a novel? She asked in dialect.
I think so.
Did you write it or not?
Yes.
Will they pay you?
I don't know.
I went out, ran to the bar Salata, where you could make long-distance phone calls in some comfort. After several attempts, Giliola called from the bar. Go on, talk. Pietro answered, but he had to work and was in a hurry. He said that he didn't know anything more about the business than he had written me.
Did you read it?
I asked in agitation. Yes.
But you never said anything.
He stammered something about lack of time, studying, responsibilities.
How is it?
Good.
Good, and that's all?
Good. Talk to my mother. I'm a philologist, not a literary person.
He gave me the number of his parents' house.
I don't want to telephone. I'm embarrassed.
I sensed some irritation, rare in him who was always so courteous.
He said, "You've written a novel. You take responsibility for it."
I scarcely knew Adele Arolta. I had seen her 4 times, and we had exchanged only a few formal remarks. In all that time, I had been sure she was a wealthy, cultivated wife and mother.
The Arotas never said anything about themselves.
They acted as if their activities in the world were of scant interest, yet took it for granted that these activities were known to everyone. And only now began to realize that she had a job, that she was able to exercise power. I telephoned anxiously. The maid answered, gave her the phone. I was greeted cordially, but she used the formal lei, and I did too. She said that at the publishing house they were all very excited about how good the book was, and, as far as she knew, a draft of the contract had already been sent.
Contract?
Of course. Have you dealt with other publishers?
No.
But I haven't even reread what I wrote.
You wrote only a single draft? All at once?
She asked, vaguely ironic.
Yes.
I assure you that it's ready for publication.
I still need to work on it.
Trust yourself. Don't touch a comma. There is sincerity, naturalness, and a mystery in the writing that only true books have.
She congratulated me again, although she accentuated the irony. She said that, as I knew, even the Aeneid wasn't polished. She ascribed to me a long apprenticeship as a writer, asked if I had other things, appeared amazed when I confessed that it was the first thing I had written.
"Talent and luck," she exclaimed.
She told me that there was an unexpected opening in the editorial list, and my novel had been considered not only very good, but lucky. They thought of bringing it out in the spring.
"So soon?
Are you opposed?"
I quickly said no.
Giliola, who was behind the bar and had listened to the phone call, finally asked me, inquisitively, "What's happening?"
"I don't know,"
I said, and left.
I wandered around the neighborhood, overwhelmed by an incredulous joy, my temples pounding. My answer to Giliola hadn't been a hostile way of cutting her off. I really didn't know. What was that unexpected announcement? A few lines from Pietro, long-distance words. Nothing certainly true.
And what was a contract? It meant money? It meant rights and duties? Was I in danger of getting in some trouble?
In a few days, I'll find out that they've changed their mind, I thought. The book won't be published. They'll reread the story. Those who found it good will find it pointless. Those who haven't read it will be angry with those who were eager to publish it. They'll all be angry with Adele Arolta. And Adele Arolta herself will change her mind. She'll feel humiliated. She'll blame me for disgracing her. She'll persuade her son to leave me. I passed the building where the old neighborhood library was. How long it had been since I'd set foot in it. I went in. It was empty. It smelled of dust and boredom. I moved absent-mindedly along the shelves. I touched tattered books without looking at title or author, just to feel them with my fingers. Old paper, curled cotton threads, letters of the alphabet, ink. Volumes, a dizzying word. I looked for Little Women. I found it. Was it possible that it was really about to happen? Possible that what Leela and I had planned to do together was happening to me? In a few months, there would be printed paper, sewn, pasted, all covered with my words. And on the cover, the name Elena Greco, me, breaking the long chain of illiterates, semi-literates, an obscure surname that would be charged with light for eternity. In a few years, 3, 5, 10, 20, the book would end up on those shelves, in the library of the neighborhood where I was born. It would be cataloged. People would ask to borrow it to find out what the daughter of the porter had written. I heard the flush of the toilet. I waited for Maestro Ferraro to appear, just as when I was a diligent girl. The same fleshless face, perhaps more wrinkled. The crew-cut hair, white, but still thick over the low forehead. Here's someone who could appreciate what was happening to me, who would more than justify my burning head, the fierce pounding in my temples. But from the bathroom, a stranger emerged, a small, rotund man of around 40.
"Do you want to take out books?" he asked. "Do it quickly, because I'm about to close."
I was looking for Maestro Ferraro.
"Ferraro is retired."
"Do it quickly." He was about to close. I laughed. Just now that I was becoming a writer, there was no one in the entire neighborhood capable of saying, "What an extraordinary thing you've done." 121.
I didn't imagine that I would earn money, but I received the draft of the contract and discovered that, surely thanks to Adele's support, the publisher was giving me an advance of 200,000 lire, 100 on signing and 100 on delivery. My mother was speechless. She couldn't believe it. My father said,
"It takes months for me to earn that much money."
They both began to brag in the neighborhood and outside. "Our daughter has become rich. She's a writer. She's marrying a university professor."
I flourished again. I stopped studying for the teacher's college exam. As soon as the money arrived, I bought a dress, some makeup, went for the first time in my life to the hairdresser, and left for Milan, a city unknown to me. At the station, I had trouble orienting myself. Finally, I found the right metro and arrived nervously at the door of the publishing house. I gave 1,000 explanations to the porter, who hadn't asked me anything, and who, in fact, while I spoke, continued to read the newspaper. I went up in the elevator. I knocked. I went in. I was struck by how neat and tidy it was. My head was crowded with all that I had studied, and I wanted to display it, to demonstrate that even if I was a woman, even if you could see my origins, I was a person who at 23 had won the right to publish that book. And now, nothing, nothing, nothing about me could be called into question. I was greeted politely, led from office to office. I talked with the editor who was working on my manuscript, an old man, bald, with a very pleasant face. We talked for a couple of hours. He praised me. He cited Adele Arota often, with great respect. He showed me some revisions that he suggested. He left me a copy of the text and his notes. As he was saying goodbye, he added, in a serious voice, "The story is good. A contemporary story very well expressed. The writing is always surprising. But that's not the point. It's the third time I've read the book, and on every page there is something powerful whose origin I can't figure out." I turned red. thanked him. Ah, how much I had been able to do, and how rapid it all was, how well-liked I was, and how likable I had become. I could speak about my studies, where I had done them, about my thesis on the fourth book of the Aeneid. I replied with courteous precision to courteous observations, mimicking perfectly the tones of Professor Galliani,
of her children, of Maria Rosa.
A pretty amiable woman named Gina asked if I needed a hotel, and, at my nod of assent, found me one on Via Garibaldi. To my great amazement, I discovered that everything was charged to the publisher, everything that I spent on food, the train tickets. Gina told me to present a record of expenses. I would be reimbursed. And she asked me to say hello to Adele for her. She called me, she said. She's very fond of you.
The next day I left for Pisa. I wanted to embrace Pietro.
On the train, I considered one by one the editor's notes, and, satisfied, I saw my book with the eyes of one who praised it and was working to make it even better. I arrived very pleased with myself. My fiancé found me a place to sleep at the house of an old assistant professor of Greek literature, whom I also knew. In the evening, he took me to dinner, and to my surprise, showed me my manuscript. He too had a copy, and had made some notes. We looked at them together, one by one. They bore the imprint of his usual rigor, and had to do mostly with the vocabulary. I'll take care of them, I said, thanking him. After dinner, we walked to an isolated meadow. After we had held and touched each other for a long time in the cold, obstructed by coats and woolen sweaters, he asked me to revise and polish with care the pages where the protagonist loses her virginity on the beach. I said, bewildered, "It's an important moment."
You yourself said that that part is a bit risque.
At the publisher, no one objected.
They'll talk to you about it later.
I became irritated. I told him that I would think about it, and the next day I left for Naples in a bad mood. If that episode upset Pietro, who was a young man of wide reading and had written a book on Bacchic rites, what would my mother and father say, my siblings, the neighborhood, if they read it? On the train, I worked on the manuscript, keeping in mind the observations of the editor and Pietro's, and what I could eliminate, I did. I wanted the book to be good. I didn't want anyone to dislike it. I doubted that I would ever write another.
122. As soon as I got home, I had some bad news. My mother, convinced that it was her right to look at my mail when I was absent, had opened a package that came from Potenza. In the package, she had found a number of my notebooks from elementary school and a note from Maestra Oliviero's sister. The teacher, the note said, had died peacefully 20 days earlier. She had often remembered me in recent times, and had asked that some notebooks from elementary school that she had saved be returned to me. I was distressed, even more than my sister Elisa, who wept inconsolably for hours. This bothered my mother, who first yelled at her younger daughter, and then, so that I, her older daughter, could hear it clearly, commented aloud, "That imbecile always thought she was more of a mother than I am." All day I thought of Maestra Oliviero, and of how she would have been proud to know about my degree, about the book I was going to publish. When everyone went to bed, I shut myself in the silent kitchen and leafed through the notebooks one after the other. How well she had taught me, the teacher. What beautiful handwriting she had instilled. Too bad that my adult writing had gotten smaller, that speed had simplified the letters. I smiled at the spelling mistakes, marked with furious strokes, at the goods, the excellence, which she wrote punctiliously in the margin when she found a good expression, or the right solution to a difficult problem, at the high marks she always gave me. Had she really been more mother than my mother? For a time I hadn't been sure, but she had imagined for me a road that my mother wasn't able to imagine, and had compelled me to take it. For this I was grateful to her. I was putting aside the package to go to bed, when I noticed in the middle of one of the notebooks a small thin sheaf of paper, 10 pages of graph paper fastened with a pin and refolded. I felt a sudden emptiness in my chest. I recognized the blue fairy, the story that Leela had written so many years before. How many? 13, 14. How I had loved the cover colored with pastels, the beautifully drawn letters of the title. At the time, I had considered it a real book and had been envious of it. I opened it to the center page. The pin had rusted, leaving brown marks on the paper. I saw, with amazement, that the teacher had written beside a sentence, "Beautiful." So she had read it? So she had liked it? I turned the pages one after the other. They were full of her wonderfuls, goods, very goods. I got angry. "Old witch," I thought. "Why didn't you tell us that you liked it? Why did you deny Leela that satisfaction? What drove you to fight for my education and not for hers? Is the refusal of the shoemaker to let his daughter take the admission examination enough to justify you? What unhappiness did you have in your head that you unloaded onto her?" I began to read the blue fairy from the beginning, racing over the pale ink, the handwriting so similar to mine of that time. But already at the first page, I began to feel sick to my stomach, and soon I was covered with sweat. Only at the end, however, did I admit what I had understood after a few lines. Leela's childish pages were the secret heart of my book. Anyone who wanted to know what gave it warmth and what the origin was of the strong but invisible thread that joined the sentences would have had to go back to that child's packet. 10 notebook pages, the rusty pin, the brightly colored cover, the title, and not even a signature. 123. I didn't sleep all night. I waited until it was day. The long hostility toward Leela dissolved. Suddenly, what I had taken from her seemed to me much more than what she had ever been able to take from me. I decided to go right away to San Giovanni a Tiduccio. I wanted to give her back the blue fairy, show her my notebooks, page through them together, enjoy the teacher's comments. But most of all, I felt the need to have her sit beside me, to tell her, "You see how connected we are? 1 in 2, 2 in 1. And prove to her with the rigor that it seemed to me I had learned in the Normale, with the philological persistence I had learned from Pietro, how her child's book had put down deep roots in my mind, and had, in the course of the years, produced another book, different, adult, mine, and yet inseparable from hers. From the fantasies that we had elaborated together in the courtyard of our games, she and I continuously formed, deformed, reformed. I wanted to embrace her, kiss her, and tell her, "Leela, from now on, Whatever happens to me or you, we mustn't lose each other anymore. But it was a hard morning. It seemed to me that the city did everything possible to get between me and her. I took a crowded bus that went toward the marina. I was unbearably squashed by miserable bodies. I got on another, even more crowded bus. I went in the wrong direction. I got out, upset, disheveled. I waited for a long time, angrily, to make up for the mistake. That small journey through Naples exhausted me. What was the use of years of middle school, high school, university in that city? To arrive at San Giovanni, I had forcibly to regress, as if Leela had gone to live not in a street or a square, but in a ripple of time past, before we went to school. A black time, without rules and without respect. I resorted to the most violent dialect of the neighborhood. I insulted. I was insulted. I threatened. I was mocked. I responded by mocking, a spiteful art in which I was trained. Naples had been very useful in Pisa, but Pisa was no use in Naples. It was an obstacle. Good manners, cultured voice and appearance, the crush in my head and on my tongue of what I had learned in books were all immediate signs of weakness that made me a secure prey, one of those who don't struggle. On the buses and the streets heading toward San Giovanni, I fused the old capacity to stop being meek at the right moment with the pride of my new state. I had a degree. I had had lunch with Professor Arota. I was engaged to his son. I had deposited money in the post office. In Milan, I had been treated with respect by important people. How could these shitty people dare? I felt a power that no longer knew how to adjust to the pretend not to notice with which, in general, it was possible to survive in the neighborhood and outside it. Whenever, in the throng of passengers, I felt male hands on my body, I gave myself the sacrosanct right to fury and reacted with cries of contempt. I said unrepeatable words, like the ones my mother and especially Leela knew how to say. I was so excessive that when I got off the bus, I was sure that someone would jump off behind me and murder me. It didn't happen. But I walked away angry and scared. I had been much too neat when I left the house. Now I felt mangled, outside and in. I tried to compose myself. I said to myself, "Calm down, you're almost there." I asked the passersby for directions. I walked along Corso San Giovanni a Tiduccio with the cold wind in my face. It seemed a yellowish channel with defaced walls, black doorways, dirt. I wandered, confused by friendly information so crowded with details that it turned out to be useless. Finally, I found the street, the building. I went up the dirty stairs, following a strong odor of garlic, the voices of children. A very fat woman in a green sweater looking out of an open door saw me and cried, "Who do you want?" "Caracci," I said. But seeing that she was perplexed, I corrected myself immediately. "Scano," Enzo's surname. And then afterward, "Cerullo." At that point, the woman repeated "Cerullo" and said, raising a large arm, "Farther up." I thanked her. Kept going, while she leaned over the banister and, looking up, shouted, "Titi, there's someone looking for Leela. She's coming up." Leela. Here, in the mouths of strangers, in this place. I realized only then that I had in mind Leela as I had seen her the last time, in the apartment in the new neighborhood, in the orderliness that, however charged with anguish it had been, now seemed the backdrop of her life,
the furniture, the refrigerator, the television, the well-cared-for child. She herself, with a look certainly worn out, but still that of a well-off young woman. I knew nothing at that moment of how she lived, what she did. The gossip had stopped at the abandonment of her husband, at the incredible fact that she had left a beautiful house and money and gone away with Enzo Scano. I didn't know about the encounter with Socavo. So I had left the neighborhood in the certainty that I would find her in a new house, among open books and educational games for her son, or, at most, out momentarily, doing the shopping. And, out of laziness, in order not to feel uneasy, I had mechanically placed those images inside a toponymy. San Giovanni Attiduccio, beyond the Granili, at the end of the marina. I went up without expectation. I thought, I've made it. Here I am at my destination. So I reached Titina, a young woman with a baby in her arms who was crying quietly, with slight sobs, rivulets of mucus dripping onto her upper lip from cold, reddened nostrils, and two more children attached to her skirts, one on each side. Titina turned her gaze to the door opposite, closed. "Lena's not here," she said, in a hostile tone. "Nor Enzo?" "No." "Did she take the child for a walk?" "Who are you?" "My name is Elena Greco. I'm a friend."
"And you don't recognize Renuccio?" "Renu, have you ever seen this lady?"
She boxed the ear of one of the children beside her, and only then I recognized him. The child smiled at me. He said in Italian, "Hello, Aunt Lenu. Mama will be back tonight at 8. I picked him up, hugged him, praised how cute he was, and how well he spoke. "He's very clever," Titina admitted. "He's a born professor." At that point, her hostility ceased. She invited me to come in. In the dark corridor, I stumbled on something that surely belonged to the children. The kitchen was untidy. Everything was sunk in a grayish light. There was a sewing machine with some material still under the needle, and around and on the floor, other fabric of various colors. Suddenly ashamed, Titina tried to straighten the room. Then she gave up and made coffee, but continuing to hold her daughter in her arms. I sat Renuccio on my lap, asked him stupid questions that he answered with lively resignation. The woman, meanwhile, told me about Lila and Enzo. "She makes salami at Socavo," she said. I was surprised. Only then did I remember Bruno. "Socavo, the sausage people?" "Socavo, yes. I know him. They are not nice people. I know the son. Grandfather, father, and son, same shit. They made money and forgot they ever went around in rags." I asked about Enzo. She said he worked at the locomotives. She used that expression. And I soon realized that she thought he and Lila were married. She called Enzo, with liking and respect, Signor Cerullo. "When will Lina be back?" "Tonight." "And the child?" "He stays with me, eats, plays, does everything here." So the journey wasn't over. I approached. Lila moved away. I asked, "How long does it take to walk to the factory?" 20 minutes. Titina gave me directions, which I wrote down on a piece of paper. Meanwhile, Renuccio asked politely, "May I go play, Aunt?" He waited for me to say yes. He ran into the hall with the other child, and immediately I heard him yelling a nasty insult in dialect. The woman gave me an embarrassed look and shouted from the kitchen in Italian, "Reno, bad words aren't nice. Watch out or I'll come and give you a rap on the knuckles."
I smiled at her, remembering my trip on the bus. I also deserve a rap on the knuckles, I thought. I'm in the same condition as Renuccio. When the quarrel in the hall didn't stop, we ran out. The two boys were hitting each other, throwing things, and yelling fiercely.
124. I arrived at the site of the Socavo factory by a dirt path, amid trash of every type, a thread of black smoke in the frozen sky. Before I even saw the boundary wall, I noticed a sickening odor of animal fat mixed with burned wood. The guard said, derisively, "You don't go visiting your girlfriend during working hours." I asked to speak to Bruno Socavo. He changed his tone, stammered that Bruno almost never came to the factory. "Call him at home," I replied. He was embarrassed. He said that he couldn't bother him for no reason. "If you don't call," I said, "I'll go and find a telephone and do it myself." He gave me a nasty look. He didn't know what to do. A man came by on a bicycle, braked, said something obscene to him in dialect. The guard appeared relieved to see him. He began to talk to him as if I no longer existed. At the center of the courtyard, a bonfire was burning. The flame cut the cold air for a few seconds as I passed. I reached a low building of a yellow color. I pushed open a heavy door. I entered. The smell of fat, already strong outside, was unendurable. I met a girl who, obviously angry, was fixing her hair with agitated gestures. I said, "Excuse me." She passed by with her head down, took three or four steps, stopped. "What is it?" she asked rudely. "I'm looking for someone called Cerullo." "Lina?" "Yes." "Look in sausage stuffing." I asked where it was. She didn't answer. She walked away. I pushed open another door. I was assailed by a warmth that made the odor of fat even more nauseating. The place was big. There were tubs full of milky, steaming water, in which dark bodies floated, stirred by slow, bent silhouettes, workers immersed up to their hips. I didn't see Lila. I asked a man who, lying on the swampy tile floor, was fixing a pipe. "Do you know where I could find Lina?"
"Cerullo?"
"Cerullo."
"In the mixing department."
"They told me stuffing."
"Then why are you asking me if you know?"
"Where is mixing?"
"Straight ahead."
"And stuffing?"
"To the right. If you don't find her there, look where they're stripping the meat off the carcasses, or in the storerooms. They're always moving her."
"Why?" He had a malicious smile.
"Is she a friend of yours?"
"Yes."
"Forget it."
"Tell me."
"You won't be offended?"
"No."
"She's a pain in the ass."
I followed the directions. No one stopped me. The workers, both men and women, seemed to be enveloped in a bitter indifference. Even when they laughed or shouted insults, they seemed remote from their very laughter, from their voices, from the swill they handled, from the bad smell. I emerged among women in blue smocks who worked with the meat, caps on their heads. The machines produced a clanking sound and a mush of soft, ground, mixed matter. But Lila wasn't there, and I didn't see her where they were stuffing skins with the rosy pink paste mixed with bits of fat, or where, with sharp knives, they skinned, gutted, cut, using the blades with a dangerous frenzy. I found her in the storerooms. She came out of a refrigerator, along with a sort of white breath. With the help of a short man, she was carrying a reddish block of frozen meat on her back. She placed it on a cart. She started to go back into the cold.
I immediately saw that one hand was bandaged. Leela. She turned cautiously, stared at me uncertainly.
What are you doing here? She said. Her eyes were feverish, her cheeks more hollow than usual, and yet she seemed large, tall.
She too wore a blue smock, but over it a kind of long coat, and on her feet she wore army boots. I wanted to embrace her, but I didn't dare. I was afraid, I don't know why, that she would crumble in my arms. It was she, instead, who hugged me for long minutes. I felt the damp material that gave off a smell even more offensive than the smell in the air.
Come, she said, let's get out of here.
And shouted at the man who was working with her, 2 minutes! She drew me into a corner.
How did you find me?
I came in.
And they let you pass?
I said I was looking for you, and that I was a friend of Bruno's.
Good. That way they'll be convinced that I give the son of the owner blowjobs, and they'll leave me alone.
What do you mean?
That's how it works.
Here?
Everywhere. Did you get your degree?
Yes. But an even more wonderful thing happened, Leela. I wrote a novel, and it's being published in April. Her complexion was gray. She seemed bloodless, and yet she flared up. I saw the red move up along her throat, her cheeks, up to the edge of her eyes, so close that she squeezed them as if fearing that the flame would burn the pupils. Then she took my hand and kissed it, first on the back, then on the palm.
I'm happy for you, she murmured.
But at the moment, I scarcely noticed the affection of the gesture. I was struck by the swelling of her hands and the wounds, cuts old and new, a fresh one on the thumb of her left hand whose edges were inflamed. And I could imagine that under the bandage on her right hand, she had an even worse injury.
What have you done to yourself?
She immediately withdrew, put her hands in her pockets.
Nothing. Stripping meat off the bones ruins your fingers.
You strip the meat?
They put me where they like.
Talk to Bruno.
Bruno is the worst shit of them all. He shows up only to see who of us he can fuck in the aging room.
Leela,
it's the truth.
Are you ill?
I'm very well. Here in the storerooms, they give me 10 lire more an hour for cold damage.
The man called, Cheru, the 2 minutes are up.
Coming,
she said. I murmured, Maestra Oliviero died. She shrugged and said,
she was sick. It was bound to happen.
I added in a hurry, because I saw that the man next to the cart was getting anxious. She let me have the blue fairy.
What's the blue fairy?
I looked at her to see if it was true that she didn't remember, and she seemed sincere. The book you wrote when you were 10.
Book?
That's what we called it.
Leela pressed her lips together, shook her head. She was alarmed. She was afraid of getting in trouble at work.
But in my presence, she acted the part of someone who does as she likes. I have to go, I thought. She said,
a long time has passed since then,
and shivered.
Do you have a fever?
No. I looked for the packet in my purse, gave it to her. She took it, recognized it, but showed no emotion.
I was an arrogant child, she muttered.
I quickly contradicted her.
The story is still beautiful today, I said. I read it again, and discovered that, without realizing it, I've always had it in my mind. That's where my book comes from.
From this nonsense? She laughed loudly, nervously.
Then whoever printed it is crazy.
The man shouted, I'm waiting for you, Cherulo.
You're a pain in the ass, she answered. She put the packet in her pocket and took me under the arm. We went toward the exit. I thought of how I had dressed up for her, and how hard it had been to get to that place. I had imagined tears, confidences, talk, a wonderful morning of confessions and reconciliation. Instead, here we were, walking arm in arm, she bundled up, dirty, scarred, I disguised as a young lady of good family. I told her that Rinuccio was cute and very intelligent. I praised the neighbor, asked about Enzo. She was glad that I had found the child well. She in turn praised the neighbor. But it was the mention of Enzo that kindled her. She lighted up, became talkative. He's kind, she said. He's good. He's not afraid of anything. He's extremely smart, and he studies at night. He knows so many things. I had never heard her talk about anyone in that way. I asked, what does he study?
Mathematics.
Enzo?
Yes. He read something about electronic calculators or saw an ad, I don't know, and he got excited. He says a calculator isn't like you see in the movies, all colored lights that light up and go out with a bip. He said it's a question of languages.
Languages?
She had that familiar, narrow gaze. Not languages for writing novels, she said.
And the dismissive tone in which she uttered the word novels disturbed me. The laugh that followed disturbed me.
Programming languages. At night, after the baby goes to sleep, Enzo starts studying.
Her lower lip was dry, cracked by the cold, her face marred by fatigue. And yet, with what pride she had said, he starts studying. I saw that, in spite of the third person singular, it wasn't only Enzo who was excited about the subject.
And what do you do?
I keep him company. He's tired, and if he's by himself, he feels like sleeping. But together, it's great. One of us says one thing, one another. You know what a flow chart is?
I shook my head. Her eyes then became very small, and she let go of my arm. She began to talk, drawing me into that new passion. In the courtyard, with the odor of the bonfire and the stink of animal fats, flesh, nerves, this Leela, wrapped up in an overcoat, but also wearing a blue smock, her hands cut, disheveled, very pale, without a trace of makeup, regained life and energy. She spoke of the reduction of everything to the alternative true-false. She quoted Boolean algebra and many other things I knew nothing about. And yet her words, as usual, fascinated me. As she spoke, I saw the wretched house at night, the child sleeping in the other room. I saw Enzo sitting on the bed, worn out from work on the locomotives in who knows what factory. I saw her, after the day at the cooking tubs, or in the gutting room, or in the storerooms at 20 below 0, sitting with him on the blanket. I saw them both, in the terrible light of sacrificed sleep. I heard their voices. They did exercises with the flow charts. They practiced cleaning the world of the superfluous. They charted the actions of the day according to only two values of truth, 0 and 1. Obscure words in the miserable room, whispered so as not to wake Rinuccio. I understood that I had arrived there full of pride, and realized that, in good faith, certainly with affection, I had made that whole journey mainly to show her what she had lost and what I had won. But she had known from the moment I appeared, and now,
risking tensions with her workmates and fines. She was explaining to me that I had won nothing, that in the world there is nothing to win, that her life was full of varied and foolish adventures as much as mine, and that time simply slipped away without any meaning, and it was good just to see each other every so often, to hear the mad sound of the brain of one echo in the mad sound of the brain of the other. "Do you like living with him?" I asked.
"Yes."
"Will you have children?" She had an expression of feigned amusement.
"We're not together."
"No?"
"No, I don't feel like it."
"And he?"
"He's waiting."
"Maybe he's like a brother."
"No, I like him."
"So?"
"I don't know."
We stopped beside the fire. She gestured toward the guard.
"Look out for him," she said.
"When you go out, he's liable to accuse you of stealing a mortadella, just so he can search you and put his hands all over you." We embraced. We kissed each other. I said I would see her again. I didn't want to lose her. And I was sincere. She smiled. She said,
"Yes, I don't want to lose you either."
I felt that she too was sincere. I went away in great agitation. Inside was the struggle to leave her, the old conviction that without her, nothing truly important would ever happen to me. And yet, I felt the need to get away, to free my nostrils of that stink of fat. After a few quick steps, I couldn't help it. I turned to wave again. I saw her standing beside the bonfire, without the shape of a woman in that outfit, as she leafed through the pages of the Blue Fairy. Suddenly, she threw it on the fire. 125. I hadn't told her what the story of my book was, or when it would be in bookstores. I hadn't even told her about Pietro, of the plan to get married in a couple of years. Her life had overwhelmed me, and it took days for me to restore clear outlines and depth to mine. What finally restored me to myself, but what myself, was the proofs of the book. 139 pages, thick paper, the words of the notebook, fixed by my handwriting, which had become pleasantly alien thanks to the printed characters. I spent happy hours reading, rereading, correcting. Outside it was cold. A frigid wind slipped in through the loose window frames. I sat at the kitchen table with Gianni and Elisa, who were studying. My mother was busily working around us, but with surprising care, in order not to disturb me. Soon I went to Milan again. This time I allowed myself, for the first time in my life, to take a taxi. The bald editor, at the end of a day spent evaluating the final corrections, said to me, "I'll call you a taxi." And I didn't know how to say no. So it happened that when I went from Milan to Pisa, at the station I looked around and thought, "Why not? Let's play the great lady again." And the temptation resurfaced when I returned to Naples in the chaos of Piazza Garibaldi. I would have liked to arrive in the neighborhood in a taxi, sitting comfortably in the back seat, a driver at my service, who, when we reached the gate, would open the door for me. I took the bus instead. I didn't feel up to it. But something about me must have been different, because when I greeted Ada, who was taking her baby out for a walk, she looked at me distractedly and walked by. Then she stopped, turned back, said, "How well you look. I didn't recognize you. You're different." At the moment, I was pleased. But soon I became unhappy. What advantage could I have gained from becoming different? I wanted to remain myself, chained to Leela, to the courtyard, to the lost dolls, to Don Achille, to everything. It was the only way to feel intensely what was happening to me. Yet change is hard to oppose. In that period, in spite of myself, I changed more than in the years in Pisa. In the spring, the book came out, which, much more than my degree, gave me a new identity. When I showed a copy to my mother, to my father, to my sister and brothers, they passed it around in silence, but without looking through it. They stared at the cover with uncertain smiles. They were like police agents confronted with a fake document. My father said, "It's my surname." But he spoke without satisfaction, as if suddenly, instead of being proud of me, he had discovered that I had stolen money from his pocket. Days passed. The first reviews came out. I scanned them anxiously, wounded by even the slightest hint of criticism. I read the best ones aloud to my whole family. My father brightened. Elisa said teasingly, "You should have signed Linucha. Elena's disgusting." In those frenzied days, my mother bought a photograph album and began to paste in it everything good that was written about me. One morning, she asked, "What's the name of your fiancé?" She knew, but she had something in mind, and to communicate it, she wished to start there. "Pietro Arota." "Then you'll be called Arota." "Yes." "And if you write another book, on the cover, will it say Arota?"
"No."
"Why?"
"Because I like Elena Greco."
"So do I," she said.
But she never read it. My father didn't read it. Pepe, Gianni, Elisa didn't read it. And at first, the neighborhood didn't read it. One morning, a photographer came and kept me for 2 hours, first in the gardens, then along the Stradone, then at the entrance to the tunnel, taking photographs. Later, one of the pictures appeared in Il Mattino. I expected passers-by would stop me on the street, would read the book out of curiosity. Instead, no one. Not Alfonso, Ada, Carmen, Giliola, Michele Solada, who, unlike his brother Marcello, wasn't a complete stranger to the alphabet, ever said to me, as soon as they could, "Your book is wonderful," or, "Who knows, your book is terrible." They only greeted me warmly and went on. I encountered readers for the first time in a bookstore in Milan. The event, I soon discovered, had been urgently planned by Adele Arota, who was following the book's journey at a distance and traveled purposely from Genoa for the occasion. She came to the hotel, kept me company all afternoon, tried tactfully to calm me. I had a tremor in my hands that wouldn't go away. I struggled with words. I had a bitter taste in my mouth. I was angry with Pietro, who had stayed in Pisa. He was busy. Maria Rosa, who lived in Milan, made a quick congratulatory visit before the reading, and then she had to go. I went to the bookstore terrified. The room was full. I went in with my eyes down. I thought I would faint with emotion. Adele greeted many of those present. They were friends and acquaintances of hers. She sat in the first row, gave me encouraging looks, turned occasionally to talk to a woman of her age who was sitting behind her. Until that moment, I had spoken in public only twice, forced to by Franco, and the audience then was made up of 6 or 7 of his friends who smiled with understanding. The situation was different now. I had before me some 40 refined, cultivated strangers who stared at me in silence with an unfriendly gaze. It was, in large part, the prestige of the Arotas that compelled them to be there. I wanted to get